WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Clifton Talbert writes in his memoir, When We Were Colored, "I would never want to return to forced segregation, but I also have a deeply felt sense that important values were conveyed to me in my colored childhood. Values we are in danger of losing in our integrated world." He goes on to describe the loving and protective environment his extended family provided for him, growing up in starkly segregated Glen Allen, Mississippi in the 1950s. He attended separate but equal schools, worked in the cotton fields, and was self-consciously deferential with whites. But his family taught him self-reliance, and after graduating from high school, he headed to St. Louis to get further education and find work. He wrote about those experiences in his second memoir, The Last Train North, which was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Both these books are out in paperback, and When We Were Colored is now a movie. Let's begin with Clifton Talbert reading from his first memoir. This is a passage about going with his grandfather to visit Greenville, a town near Glen Allen.
"Wake up, boy. Wake up, we hear," Papa nudged. As I raised up to look around me, Papa was busy trying to find a parking space down by the levee. After Papa put his pennies in the meter, he'd grab my hand, and together we'd walk down the street to the bakery and the frozen custard stand. Because I was so fascinated by the crowd, Papa would jerk my hands to remind me of my place. I was so excited to get to the frozen custard stand that I hardly watched where I was walking. But he would pull me up just in time so that we could step aside and let white people pass. Papa would tip his hat and hold me closely by his side until the white people were clearly in front of us. Secure in the grip of Papa's calloused hands, I never stopped smiling because I could see the frozen custard stand. I had not a care in the world as I purchased my double cone of frozen custard ice cream, holding it in one hand while Papa's strong grip held my other. I was totally content. My world was complete and colored. With frozen custard dripping from my mouth, I walked with Papa a little further to the bakery. We could smell hot French bread all the way up the street. "That long piece of French bread, please, sir," Papa asked the baker, as we both inhaled the yeasty smells of the bakery. "Anything else, preacher?" the baker asked, handing us the wrapped package. Reaching out to accept our money, the baker made sure his white hands did not touch Papa's strong colored ones. Once outside, this man I loved began to break the hot loaf into small pieces, and we ate as we walked back to the levee. Papa with his French bread and I with the last of my frozen custard walked down Washington Avenue hand in hand. Papa would complete the rest of his errands and visit a few friends. Then we'd begin the trip home to Glen Allen. I would settle in for a long nap as my Saturday ended, and Papa hummed, "That evening sun is setting fast."
And that's my guest, Clifton Talbert, reading from his memoir, When We Were Colored. I think that passage shows many things, but one of them is the subtleties of trying to navigate in that segregated world where your grandfather would pull you in to make sure that whites could pass you, where you noticed that white hands and black hands didn't touch when money changed hands. Is that how your family taught you to navigate this difficult world?
I don't think it was a teaching that one would give lessons and you would respond. But I've often said that Papa became an umbrella for a little boy who didn't have the power to stop the torrents of the rain of racism. And I lived under the shadow of that umbrella. And under that umbrella is where the navigation took place.
But how did they protect you from a world, a society that decided that blacks and whites were different and that blacks were inferior to whites? How does a family protect a young, growing child from that message?
Racism lived in our community, but it didn't live in our house. And once we got on the front porch of Papa's house, that was his plot of land. That was his house. That's where he ruled and reigned. And it was from those front porches that they saw their future through the lengthening steps of their children and their grandchildren and great-grandchildren, of which I was one. And they told us who we were and from where we had come. They told us what they wanted us to be. And They made us believe that we could actually reach the stars.
Well, how much in a segregated world, and as you write about, this was a segregated world in the Deep South, how much real contact, or how much contact at all between whites and blacks?
There was contact. Social contact, as we understand it today, visiting, going to restaurants, doing things together, that type of contact did not exist. But I can remember when Mrs. Brown, the white family across the street, if she was cooking a cake and she ran out of flour or eggs, she was sent across our house to get some.
Would your mother, grandmother do that if she ran out of eggs or flour?
But we bought milk and eggs from them. And I can remember going into their home to get things. But I also knew that we, even though we would wave at each other, there was this invisible barrier that was there, a chasm that was called segregation that did not allow us to cross.
What does colored mean? And for a white person, it's awkward for me to say that word, but you use it and other people have used it, and it's certainly very much a part of your writing. What does that mean?
It's a time. It's the one word that conjures up the aunts and uncles, the grandparents, the Saturday fish fries, the sister worker society within the colored churches. It's the one word that conjures up the time that, in spite of legal segregation, there were this wonderful cadre of people that dreamed a better America. It was a term that we did not choose, but it was a term that became descriptive of who we were at a particular time in history.
Did your family believe in the American dream?
Without question.
Why?
You know, it's really funny. That was this passionate pursuit of the American dream. I mean, it was their home. America was their home, and for whatever they had suffered, they always believed that getting a piece of America was what life was really all about.
Even though the laws were against them.
Even though the laws were against them, you were pushed to college. You were pushed to achieve. And going north was not just to move out of a Jim Crow environment as much as it was to express those wonderful talents that they knew to be there, and they wanted to find a place for that expression.
Were you afraid, or are you afraid at all, that by writing about this part of your life and this piece of American history, that you are going to give segregation a good name?
No, you can't give segregation a good name. The times were bad, but the people were good. And that's what I've tried to do. I've tried to recall the good people who helped us to live through the bad times.
You write that your family seldom discussed politics. The only part, I guess, of politics that they discussed, which affected them very personally, was the poll tax. But one of your relatives says that's white folks' business.
Yeah, that the Freedom Riders, the civil rights movement, in the book that I'm writing now, they were the people who came into our world to unearth that desire to be involved. I've often said that Papa and the old preachers would sit in the front room, if you will, and there they would hold their version of meetings, a Congress that was in session, but no bills could be enacted. They weren't allowed to do that. They didn't understand the system, and the system was rigged in such a way that they weren't welcomed participants in it. And even the poster that you're referring to of Adlai Stevenson when he was running for president, the poster covered the wall of the Jake Stein store. And I remember sitting in the cab of my father's truck, and I said, "Who's that?"
Mm.
And it was a political candidate. And I remember distinctively my mother saying, "You don't need to know about that. That's white folks' business." We were so removed to a great extent from being involved in that world of politics, except for the NAACP, which was a voice for small towns and people like us.
Well, did the church replace the political party or the political life? Because you say the church was the sanctuary for our dreams and the closet for our secrets.
It didn't replace it, But what it did, it provided an outlet. The church became a microcosm of a world that we had not yet fully become part of. And within the church structure, you had your presidents, you had your Congress, you had your legislative members, you had your financial institutions. It was a very small reflection of the broader society, but it enabled a people who had pent-up desires and emotion to be bigger than just something, to allow the church to bring it out.
Any surprise that many of the political leaders came out of the Black church?
It is no surprise to me at all, especially during the 50s and the early 60s, because that was one of the few places that allowed for freedom of expression, where one could actually vent their feelings, say what they wanted, and they were not under the auspices or under white control.
Do you remember feeling safe in church?
Yeah. Always felt safe there.
Describe for us the kind of school that you went to. The first school that you went to actually was a one-room schoolhouse, yeah. And all the children were there together.
Miss Maxie was the teacher. And I've often said, it's not that I'm so old that I went to a one-room school. It's just that Washington County took forever to change. And they built the big school. It took them years to complete it. But Miss Maxie taught in the school that had first been taught by Professor White. Everyone knew Professor White, as he was called. He taught my uncle and my mother. But once Miss Maxie came to town and all 8 grades were there in this one white building, and I'll always remember it, and she taught us all.
And how does one teach 1 through 8th grade?
Well, what you do, you become boss and you tell the other 7 to shut up. And they do, because those were the days when a teacher spoke, the students listened. And Ms. Maxie, but it was good in a way because it was an interchange of information. Not only were you learning 1st grade, but you were also hearing 2nd grade and 3rd grade and 4th grade. So it really wasn't a waste of time, as much as it probably was an effort on her part. But we would sit there and we would learn at our desk, and she would write on the blackboards, and she would dismiss us to go, you know, to the bathroom. The nurse would come to give you booster shots. I mean, it seems as if every disease cropped up around those years in school, and all the nurses were coming out to shoot you, as we call it. And we were literally afraid of that. But they wanted the best for us. And Miss Maxie would tell us that we belonged among the stars. And even though we lived in an inferior environment, we did not receive an inferior mindset.
So how equal were these separate but equal schools? Once this school building finally got constructed and you were able to move into that school, how equal would you say that education was from the white kids in your...
I would say the only thing equal about the system was the Flushing Johns. Since that both groups of us, both black and white, had grown up with outdoor toilets, we all had to learn how to use flush toilets in that part of the South. But once you got into the classrooms, the books, the materials, the support materials that were needed, we got the leftovers. I knew all the white boys' jokes because I got their books the next year. They would get the new books, and we would get the old books.
You get the hand-me-downs.
We get the hand-me-downs.
Were you aware of groups like the KKK and other?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, were you aware? Did you feel their presence?
You know, I didn't feel their presence as a child, but I was certainly aware of their existence. We knew who they were, the older people. I mean, they weren't like strangers who came into town. Many of them lived within our town. But it was a world that had existed, and it was parallel to the world we knew. And you spoke to each other occasionally. Even the man that I worked for, I later learned he was a chaplain for the Ku Klux Klan. I had no idea. But at the same time, our relationship was one that would have defied your thinking what it would have been. The South is very complicated in many of its social issues.
But would it be overstating it to say that during the day you would greet each other in the way that I guess you as a young black man was allowed to greet a white person, and at night they might be terrorizing your neighborhood?
Well, I wouldn't say terrorizing in the sense that something that happened on a continued basis. But let's say that something was going to happen that was going to certainly break the order by those people who felt we want things to stay as they are. Then this group of people, and it was not the whole town, but these group of people who somehow found it necessary to live by intimidating others and in causing fear, they seemed to come to the rescue of a system that was slowly falling around us.
Let me just talk a little bit with you about what it was like to imagine your life beyond where you grew up in Mississippi. And you had a family that was saying, Clifton, there is a life beyond this town. We want you to think beyond working in the cotton fields, which you did, but also where many people ended up spending the rest of their life. Did you feel disloyal at all to think that there was a life beyond Glen Mills, Mississippi?
No, not at all. Mr. Fields, the man I call the big shot in Glen Allen,
yeah,
he lived in a shotgun house that wasn't even his. It belonged to Mrs. Spencer. But sometimes he would take me in, on his back porch, and he would emotionally place me on his shoulders. And I remember distinctively him saying, why don't you become an architect? Be a doctor. This man had less than a third grade education, but he showed me a world that I couldn't see with my eyes. And somehow, I think in his own way, he gave his dreams to me and said, take them, boy, and see what you can do with them.
Clifton Talbert lives in Oklahoma and is working on his third memoir. His first memoir is now a movie called Once Upon a Time, When We Were Colored, and it opens January 12th in selected theaters. This is Fresh Air.